I oftentimes forget to introduce myself when I have a guest when and you're not on.
Oh.
So then I'll just be like, "Hey, it's so and so," and then I realize when I'm editing, I never said my name throughout the whole podcast. Yeah. So I have a note here on my notes. It says, "Introduce yourself" in all caps. Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. With me again is my co-host, Richard Wally.
And back again, but was always here still, Cassidy Robinson from California? Was that vague? Yeah, that was vague. Hi, Cassidy. How are you doing?
Maybe a little non-committal.
I've been feeling that way. So
I haven't talked to you in like what seems like forever.
I think it's only been like a week or two.
It's been like 2 weeks because we definitely haven't talked about Thanksgiving, which now I think we're past the point that we can have the what did you do on Thanksgiving talk.
Probably. Mostly just ate food. It's pretty boring.
Nothing exciting. The food didn't attack you in the middle of dinner.
Nobody
was poisoned.
Nobody poisoned. No Game of Thrones twists. Nothing like that. Just, we ate a lot of turkey and then turkey based meals after that. We had our Thanksgiving feast and then we had our turkey pot pie. And then for the last like week, we've been eating a turkey noodle soup that we made like a week ago. So
yeah, I miss having a mother. Somebody who knows how to make turkey noodle soup.
Well, we just made it. So right. It was you see, that's the thing is you need to become the mother, Cassidy.
you should email me. Email me some of that turkey noodle soup.
Okay, I'll get on that.
Right? We have like those digitizers like in Star Trek.
I'll just attach it, yeah.
Right.
The 3D printer maybe one day.
Mm-hmm. And then it'll like 3D print a bowl and then like drip the soup in the middle of it.
Yeah, but then you'll have to eat the bowl too because it will be part of the meal. This is a weird tangent.
This is a really weird way to start the show. And even weirder, right off the bat, I'm going to ask you, you brought up this thing when we were talking about people who've been on the show, and I said we've had a lot of Steves, or we've had two. Mm-hmm. But, and you were asking me if I thought that it, or when you know too many people with the same first name. Like, mm-hmm. I think we both know a lot of Chris's.
Yeah. And when you have vague names like Chris's and Steve's and things like that, I have a hard time sometimes. So I have to, like, be like, you're that guy. You're this Chris, or you're that Chris, or, you're talking about the Steve's, you know, you're Atheist Steve, or you're WWF Steve, or
whatever it is.
Yeah, or whatever it is.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, no. And that got me thinking, like, I have a very unique name, for better or worse.
Race?
Well, both, either my first name.
I'm Race, sorry, I have to out you every like, you
I know,
know
that I don't use, or my middle name that I use most often, Cassidy. Both are very uncommon. There were lots of times in my life when I was looking for the little license plate with your name on it in a gas station, and I never found it. But you have a really, really super common name, like a Steve or a Chris. You're Richard.
Mm-hmm. But I'm the Richard, though.
Right. That's what I was going to ask you. Like, when I hear Cassidy, even though I almost never hear about other Cassidys, every once in a while I'll encounter a girl named Cassidy.
That's the thing that I was going to say. You're boy Cassidy in my mind. I know other girl Cassidys, so.
There's a famous hip-hop artist, I'll let you know, named Cassidy, spells it the same way, who's a guy. But
well, thank you for justifying.
There you go. Look him up. I've never heard his music. So yeah, I have like a real sense of ownership of my name, and when I hear it, when I hear it used in the context of not me, it's very alarming and weird. When you hear people say Richard, or you meet another Richard at a party or in a social setting, do you have that same sense of ownership? Like, I am the Richard and you're just a Richard? Or...
I'm the artist formerly known as Richard.
Right.
No, I have no ownership of it. It doesn't... I don't know. It's a name.
You don't get that same kind of thing? Like, it's not a part of your identity, your name?
Not really. I don't know. This is getting too deep, Cassidy. This is too much of a question for me. This is getting into some like Shakespearean quotes, and I don't know. I'm not ready for this. We need to have a lighter podcast this week. It's been 2 weeks. I'm not ready for this. Throwing me into the deep end. No, I can tell you like on my, you know, gut instinct. No, I'm not really that attached to it, and I don't think that people necessarily are like what. Well, the other thing too is like the thing that I always got from like the dumb thing that I always heard, oh, Richard the Lionhearted.
Oh, like, really? Well, that's your annoying thing that you hear? I have plenty of them. Usually, well, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kids, but there's others.
See, I would like that one kind of. I would go by your first name though.
Right.
And then I would and then I'd go on adventures around the world.
Mm-hmm. And get in stuck in like booby traps in the middle of the wilderness and whatever.
Yeah. Race Cassidy Robinson.
That'll like, be my, if I become like a famous novelist.
Or adventurer.
Right.
Become an adventurer.
I don't think that there's really much in the adventuring industry anymore.
Probably not.
Today we're going to be reviewing Krampus for the main review. And at the end of the program, we're finally going to get to Richard's Netflix homework, which is Dark Star, H.R. Giger's World, the documentary about H.R. Giger, not the John Carpenter movie.
Correct.
I'm going to do this at the top of the show. We usually save letters for the end of the show, but we got a letter from Patrick, and I figure we might as well just read it out now, since he's had to wait a good while for us to get to this. So, here it is. This is Patrick from the podcast Almost Educational and Make Dad Read Comics, of which we were both guests on at different points. Go back and listen to those. He says, hey, fellas. Okay, as a preamble, I do listen to the show in 3-episode chunks during marathon training, so when I email it, it may be confusing because days and dates blend together. Sorry about that. And it says, next, great show as always. Thank you. And he says, on to Spectre, the show with Alec, which you were also not on. But
no, I didn't do that.
I'll let you chime in if you want. He says, it was a refresher, but you made mention that all Bond films have extra long titles. Untrue. There are 26 total films, and 15 have 3-word titles. Just saying.
Take that, Cassidy.
I know. I know, Patrick. In fact, I didn't mention this on the podcast because it was too much of a tangent. Not that we're totally immune to that on this podcast, but a couple weeks previous, there was a quiz question at one of my quiz nights, which was, besides Spectre, how many, name 4 other Bond movies that have 1-word titles. And I got that answer so right. So I know.
You just proved to the world your fast knowledge.
How big of a nerd I am. And it says, I enjoyed the first 20 minutes all in Mexico stuff, looking striking, moving quickly, had all the over-the-top Bond tropes. It was on the money, 007 for me. Then the rest of the film unfolded and my excitement died. Christoph Waltz felt wasted. He pops on screen, monologues, and pops back off. Monica Bellucci was also wasted and was much sexier than the female lead, which was Lea Seydoux. I think we pretty much agreed with you on that point when we reviewed the movie. And then he says, Cassidy, you nailed it. You nailed the feeling that it was one massive rehash of different Bond tropes. I had issues with Skyfall because all of a sudden James Bond became Bruce Wayne, a wealthy orphan who grows up to be the best specimen of mankind, just swap cape and cowl for 00 license to kill.
Well, yeah, everybody knows rich people are better than regular people, right?
I mean, they can afford to train, so.
That's actually kind of true, yeah.
And he says, I feel Craig era Bond is trying to jam the series that works best in the format. To borrow a comic book term, a one-shot into an ongoing series. I think the attempt to make it a modern ongoing series of films like Lord of the Rings, Dark Knight, Hunger Games, etc., just falls flat for me, and takes away one of the more interesting aspects of the Bond series, in which there is not a conscious nod to canon or continuity. So he likes it more to be just kind of willy-nilly, like every movie is a complete standalone. It could be anywhere in the continuity, rather than these modern Bond movies, which the Craig era, which is a little bit more like the Dark Knight series, or a little bit more like an ongoing kind of narrative.
Correct.
Right.
I see, for me, that's the Mad Max. People keep trying to, like, co-inflate them all together. Mm-hmm. I'm like, no, it's a folk hero of the apocalypse. It's not a real person.
It's like Robin Hood. It could be just a different interpretation of the same guy every time.
Exactly. Hmm. And it's just, you know, people trying to put their hope in a person that doesn't really exist because the whole world's already dead.
There you go. There you go, Richard. Then he has a question here. I'm not exactly 100% sure what the premise of this question is, but I'll let you see what you think. He says, for something on an entirely different topic, can you explain what's going on with the upcoming film Big Short? I feel like this came out of left field with the sudden ad blitz on television and internet. How is this film with so many big name actors only operating with purportedly $30 million budget? Is it so low because a film is a grab for awards for the actors? Is this because it comes from Pitt's production company and he has some deal with adapting Michael Lewis novels? Please explain. I'm going to say a little bit of both. So, one of the reasons it can be a little bit cheaper is because the people who are making it are kind of making it more for awards than they are a paycheck. So they're probably just getting spec rather than their usual movie star money if they're going to go and do a big summer event movie. With the exception of Pitt, who's a producer, so he's probably going to make a little bit more on the back end. I'm also going to say that $30 million you read, that's only the production. That's only actually what you see on screen. All of the media and ad blitz, that's probably another $60 million that you never see on Box Office Mojo when they talk about what a movie costs. They never pull in the advertising costs, which are often double the production costs.
So, yeah, so it'd be another, like, 30. So, that's exactly what my take would be on it, too, is basically, I think it's also an excuse for a lot of good actors to get together and be like, let's try to make a good movie. Mm-hmm. Like, because, I mean, that doesn't necessarily anymore. I don't know if it really works that way. Like, and I mean, specifically, I think the big studios are looking for names, the next big franchise, those kind of things. So actors, I think sometimes now are a little bit more, they're not as marketable.
No.
So now they have to make excuses to work together.
It takes about 4 stars to equal the star power of 1 star from like the 90s or 80s.
Right.
Also, when you're making a movie about real things that actually happened, you have to load it up with star power because real things that actually happened don't pull in the same kind of numbers as Star Wars.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of the franchise kind of like idea too, you know?
Yeah, it's like you want to see this movie about the housing collapse because it has Ryan Gosling and because it has Christian Bale, because it has Steve Carell.
No, it completely... And I mean, besides that, just looking at the IMDb, they even throw in like other random people like Max Greenfield and Melissa Leo. And
and Spotlight are huge awards contenders, and they are fully loaded with stars.
Well, the thing I was talking about, that, I mean, besides the ones I missed, like Marissa Tomei, Karen Gillian. But if you're talking about specifically Karen Gillian from Doctor Who, or Max Greenfield, who has a fairly, I would say, he has success within a certain...
fanboy kind of culture.
Well, Max Greenfield he's in Veronica Mars, and then he was also... the thing that's really made him big, though, is New Girl. And so it's more about getting that specific demographic. You show him just in a blip and you know, you get the millennials like, oh, he's a New Girl. Like, it makes sense to me what they're doing. I just don't necessarily like how they
As
do
why
it.
Donald Glover was inexplicably in The Martian?
Correct.
Yes.
I didn't see The Martian still, so I was more like, yes.
I liked it, but he was really out of nowhere in that movie.
Okay.
Okay. So thank you, Patrick. I hope we answered your questions or something.
We rambled at it sufficiently.
Right.
This could also be called, besides, jabbering and droning, it could be called
The
rambling. Rambling.
Ramblecast.
More
Do
sense,
do dee
yes.
dee dee do do. Let's go
That's the
ahead and get into
banjo.
the movie news.
Okay.
And I'll let you start with our first news item.
Okay. So just to get it, just to get the some of our bigger Marvel news, because that's
We're
in as you say,
contractually
yeah, we're contractually obligated by
obligated.
society to do this. No, I'm kind of excited though. They got Ryan Coogler or Cogler, who just did Creed. I didn't get to see that as well, but he did. I keep wanting to say Pacific Rim, but it's not that at all.
Sure isn't.
What
Fruitvale
is it?
Station?
Fruitvale Station, yeah. I don't know why. Anyways, Fruitvale Station, which I really, really dug that film. But yeah, I think that he would be probably a good fit, and I think that he's stepped up in the like because he did this little indie budget thing in Fruitvale Station, and then he steps up to something a little bit bigger and a little bit more franchisey in Creed,
Oh,
and
yeah.
then to step up to a Marvel movie. And I think it is a good step to Marvel because I feel like Marvel, what they've done better with supporting like younger like talent and stuff like that is they kind of help them in the more the backfield when it comes to like the technology and the other stuff when you jump up to a big like CGI filled action fest thing. And I don't feel like they used to do that very well. They just kind of threw you in the deep water and then your graphics would look dumb. So
Right.
I think this is a good step for him in the sense that progressionally it makes sense.
Yeah.
I know your argument is going to be that he doesn't, it's not as an interesting of a choice, but I don't know. I think Black Panther could be a strange is a strange character and could have an interesting take.
Yeah, the Black Panther. I don't know if you mentioned that at the top of the
I think
news.
I did. Did I
But
say Pink Panther? I didn't say
the
Pink
Pink
Panther.
Panther, yes. Yeah, no, actually I think this makes more sense. And in fact, this makes even more sense than Ava DuVernay, who was originally attached.
That one was strange, yeah. I understand why they went for that one, but at
Yeah.
the same time, like
Well, she
this.
had a lot of momentum coming off of last year's Oscar season, and now I'm kind of, I don't know. She is in such a weird place in Hollywood right now where she is the go-to person to ask how you feel about some racial indiscretion that's going on. And she's not even like making a movie. She has nothing to promote. So it's really out of left field anymore when they're just like, so and so said this racist thing. What do you think about that, Ava DuVernay? It's like, yeah, pretty shitty. Ava DuVernay just said that this comment was shitty. That's like
You
every
get
other
the
week.
it's kind of fun you get these inside baseball kind of things. I haven't noticed any of those little blips. That's funny.
Yeah, she's definitely maintaining a brand. Like I'll give her that. So anyway, so yeah, no, Ryan Coogler, especially coming off of Creed, which is maybe why you thought I would have thought this was less interesting.
Sure.
Having seen Creed and really enjoyed it, for all of its big sports movie cliches, he does it really, really well, and he does it with the intimacy of Fruitvale Station. I think that he could, if he's able and allowed to bring what he can do to something like Black Panther, a character I can't say I've ever been that interested in. And I'm not just saying that because it's a black character and I can't relate or blah blah blah. I've never read Black Panther as a single like
Well,
character, but whenever he pops up into other comics I read, for a little while he was married to Storm, blah blah blah. He would show up
right.
in the big event series like Civil War and that kind of stuff. And I always just thought he was kind of there. Like I didn't think it was ever that interesting of a
Well,
character.
I mean, that's the thing though too, is like I feel like this happens to a lot of nerd culture. It's just because you're like, okay, you're a Marvel guy.
Yeah.
You're not like a huge comic book guy, but you're a comic book guy. I'm a Marvel guy as well, but there are tons of titles I haven't read. I don't know every minute like little character, and so then people are like, "You know this, right?" And it's like, "No, I don't know that. Why would I know that?"
We are not a monolith.
No. Well, I mean, besides that too, like the characters I was really into are all like the street level guys.
Right.
Like the stuff that's coming out on Netflix right now, that's literally marketed towards me. Like
Yep.
literally Jessica Jones, Daredevil, Luke Cage,
Iron
kind of
Fist.
Iron Fist. I gotta say, kind of Iron Fist. But
Right.
that kind of crowd appeals to me. And honestly, it's kind of weird to me that Spider-Man's being tacked onto the Avengers because I always liked Spider-Man's street level stuff.
Yeah.
So I mean, so when people ask me or kind of talk about it in a
Assume.
certain way to me because they've got this big worldwide view of comic books. That's not where I came from, so it's very strange to me sometimes.
Well,
I'm
yeah, I
like,
mean, especially a franchise as big and as wide and as expansive as the Marvel Universe,
well,
where there's lots of different genres going. I mean, you in the same universe, you can have politically conscious stuff like the X-Men, or you can have street level noir stuff like Daredevil, and you can have Howard the Duck.
right.
Like that exists all in the same universe, and it's kind of like different genres all in itself. And yeah, I think a lot of people kind of pick and choose what version of it they like. I never really read Thor because I don't give a shit about like ancient gods living in big cities in the sky.
Oh, come on, everybody does, don't they? No, there are certain titles I would read because they are written very well, like Thor specifically. I'm thinking of J. Michael Straczynski run.
Yeah, I
That
mean,
was
there's
a
always
great
the
run.
exception. I think, like, no matter what version of the thing you're into, you'll find, like, the one story that was written for your sensibility.
Well, this isn't new, but I mean, really specifically, like, I mean, the Avengers were like, B team characters for the longest time.
Yeah.
This isn't a new thing to come up, but I just wanted to like just remind people of that. And so, Black Panther specifically, he was kind of like that too. He was somebody that everybody always has like those B string characters that they like. He was one of the ones that I was always semi partial to.
Okay. And maybe I just never read the good Black Panther story. Like I said, he was always just kind of in the background of whatever.
Well, aren't there just some background characters that you really like? For some reason, I really like Namor as well. I don't know why. I've never read like a Namor title per se, but I think Namor is a badass. He pops out of the sea and says, "What are you doing here? You imperialist? I'm gonna punch you in the face." And then he does. And then he goes back under the sea, and that's it. And I'm always like, thank you for that interlude. I'm glad you just popped out and just punched people in the face, just to remind them you're there.
Right. Yeah,
But
I
with
don't
him
know.
specifically, I think it could make an interesting story, especially from a very different angle, because when you're talking about, somebody from, I mean, you're not even talking about a hero from the States. You're talking about a hero that's in a fictitious land in Africa.
Yeah.
So I think it could add a very interesting dynamic that so far we haven't really got out of some of the other Marvel films. And specifically because of the best way to say this is like the kind of like race issues it can bring up.
Yeah.
I think it has some interesting potential. I mean, if we're talking, let's go, I mean, we can even go back to Iron Man. Iron Man was a, B slash three C string character. He wasn't ever that interesting to me until the movie came out. And then, you know what? He started being written better too, because he was written by their better writers. Whatever their best writers are writing, those characters tend to be better. And but those characters for a long time weren't written by those writers for whatever reason. So it's a very strange it's a very strange dynamic. Specifically with Black Panther though, I could see a really cool adaptation coming out of it. So
Okay.
depending on what direction they go in, it could be very bland though too.
Yeah, I mean, I
So
hope that they give him a little bit of creative freedom, and it'd be nice if he at least had a pass on the screenplay so that he could inform it a little and
well,
maybe punch it
does it
up for.
say who the writers are on
You have the article, don't you? In front of you?
it? I do, and I'm just
I
looking through it
don't.
now. I didn't know if you had it or not.
I think there's a script set up from when Ava DuVernay was involved. But like I said, now that they're bringing on a new director, a lot of times that'll the new director will at least have a look at the screenplay or be able to kind of adjust things. So we'll see.
Joe Robert Cole. Okay, that doesn't say anything to me.
Right. Yeah, I'm sure they have a treatment pretty much. And then
well,
they'll
I think
be able
they
to
always do, but I think where they give them freedom is to kind of develop the characters, not necessarily the stories as much.
Right.
Which can sometimes, make it not as good of as a product, but we'll see. I think that this has potential, and specifically with him, I think he's an interesting and certainly young and talented person, and I think this can give him a little bit of a boost too. So I approve.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, next story. Jason Priestley is set to direct a film about the life of comedian Phil Hartman entitled Nice Guy Phil. Apparently Jason Priestley met Phil Hartman when he was the guest host of Saturday Night Live back in like 1992. And apparently for whatever reason they kept in touch until Phil Hartman was murdered by his wife around 1998.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, she straight up killed him. And what's really fucked up is when you watch Saturday Night Live, the era that he was on, his like, they had the little introducing everybody thing, and Phil Hartman. It was they would show him, and then there's a blonde woman who's like sitting with him, and you just see the back of her head. That's the wife that killed him.
I'm gonna have to watch that now because that's pretty wow.
So there's that. So yeah, this is going to be a biopic about the life and accomplishments and maybe the death of Phil Hartman. Darren Norris is going to play him. And I looked him up to see if I don't know, like I don't super know who he is, but he does look a little bit like him. But I guess Jason Priestley has directed one other movie before this, like some micro indie. So there's that.
Yeah, he's just the 90210 guy to me
Right,
still.
with the
I mean,
leather
I'm not trying
jacket.
to be rude or dismissive of him. Like, he's probably fine as a person or whatever. I just don't. When you say Jason Priestley attached to this, it's just like, okay, cool story, bro. Like, it doesn't mean anything. So, strange. It's interesting that he has a personal attachment to it as well.
Yeah, which gives me a little bit more like, it's like Alex Winter, the guy who played Ted, or no, Bill from the Bill and Ted movies. He makes movies sometimes. Like he's actually made like 5 or 6 movies.
I think I knew that actually. I forgot why. I was looking up a movie a little bit ago and I was like, oh,
That
Ted directed it. Sweet.
Right. So but I think in this case, like with the maybe it's a little bit more of a passion project or there is kind of a personal involvement in it. I can't say whether or not it's going to be any good. I've never seen his first movie.
Well, yeah, I mean that's the only thing is like, okay. Well, but like I said, what I found strange about this is when I first saw it, I thought it was another article I had looked at, but it was for Luke Perry. He was going to be in a film and I was like, okay, are we having like 90210 kind of like revival kind of movies going on? What the hell is this? Like, so I was confused when I first you're like, let's talk about this. And I was like, he's directing it. I thought he was supposed to be starring in it. Oh no, it's
Right.
the other 90210 guy. Okay, wait. So
When is Shannon Doherty gonna make a movie?
Soon, I hope.
We
She's the
all
most
hope.
talented one, right? Of the
Well, she was the
bunch.
one in Mallrats. She was the one
Yeah.
that nobody liked because apparently she was incredibly difficult to work with.
Oh, okay.
She was like the Lea Michele of the 90s.
You have a wealth of, like, I know you do this, but sometimes it just surprises me, like in the show, when you have this wealth of horrible knowledge. And I'm like, where did this even come from?
This is what I know instead of how to fix a car, Richard.
Oh, okay.
I lift the trunk. I can't do anything with that, but I can give you weird, random television facts from yesteryear. What's the other news story?
So this kind of came, it kind of exploded, I guess, today. Basically, Luc Besson is going to be allowed to do this big budget sci-fi film
I love how
adapted.
you Americanize his name so much. Luc Besson.
Luc Besson, yeah. So they're doing this big, screw you, man, screw you. Anyways, he's doing this, I guess it's a book, like a pulpy book series from the 1960s. I wonder why they're giving him money to do this. It's called Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets. It's got a huge cast. So, Dane DeHaan, Cara Delevingne, I don't know how to say that.
She was in Paper Towns, yeah.
She's also going to be in the Suicide Squad.
Oh, that's right. Right.
Clive Owen, Ethan Hawke, Rihanna, and where this article comes from, John Goodman is going to be voicing a CG alien in it, apparently.
Yeah.
But I mean, besides this being like, okay, we already know this is kind of coming out of the storm of, oh, we need to like milk the sci-fi epic because Star Wars is coming out. We need to give people who can do that money. Oh, Luc Besson did that Fifth Element movie. Why
Right.
don't we have him direct something?
Which was
This
also based on a French graphic novel.
Oh, is it? I didn't
Yeah.
know that. He okay, so apparently like it's a hundred they're giving him 180 million. When was the last time anybody let Luc Besson even have over like 10 million? Like so it's just sort of interesting me to how this kind of system works now, to see it kind of evolve.
Well, this is being made through his company, Europa Corp.
Okay.
So he'll also be producing it. I guess financing it. So I'm imagining rather than making three more Takens or
So this is what
three
they're
more
doing with the.
lockouts, he's just kind of putting all of his eggs in this basket. And I'm gonna say now, I smell a flop.
Oh, see, I was gonna say you might be right.
I
But I'm.
smell a what was the movie from earlier this year, the Wachowski one?
Oh, I couldn't tell you.
Jupiter Ascending?
Yes,
Yeah.
that was the name. I couldn't even. I could barely picture it. I was like, the first thing that came to my mind when you said that was, oh yeah, that one with wolf people.
Right.
With those fucking dragon things flying around. That's the only thing I remember about it. And Terry Gilliam was in it.
Yeah.
And anyway, no, you're most likely right. You know, I want to say, because I do have a lot of love for the Fifth Element, I want to be like, yeah, there
Yeah.
could be a good one coming out of this.
Once upon a time, Luc Besson was a good filmmaker.
Yeah, The Professional, that was
The
another.
Professional is really good. La Femme Nikita is kind of like a, I would say, a landmark in action filmmaking, where the movies that came after it are distinctly different than the movies before it, in the
Agreed.
same way that John Woo kind of changed the game with his early Hong Kong work.
Right.
And he was a for real dude and world cinema filmmaker, and like, you know, but ever since Fifth Element, and he started Europa Corp and has really been doing everything in-house, he's kind of become a schlockmeister, and he's made these really cheap genre movies that are like, you know, just good enough to make a buck. And
That's still 180 million. Like, I know that they made some money off of those Taken films, don't
yeah,
get me
no,
wrong.
those did pretty well, and those became increasingly more expensive as they
Well,
went. I would say that the last one was probably close to that.
and 180 million?
I don't know. I could look it up.
I don't think so. I think it was like maybe in the like you'll have to look that up because that seems like way too much for those little action ears. That money
Yeah.
had to be Liam Neeson money. Like they were just trying to pay him just to be in it still.
Right.
No, I do. I think it's interesting that they're taking this because it does seem like a big risk. I mean, Europa Corp still isn't like one of the big. It's not one of the big guys. So for them to be putting up their own money, that's sort of interesting. That it's sort
Yeah.
of ballsy, at least in a sense, to try to go up against everybody else with their big, you know. Their Marvel and their Star Wars and their Hunger Games and all that kind of stuff. So to take a kind of unknown property and try to go for it, it is ballsy, at least, I guess is the best way to say it. But I
Right.
maybe a little foolhardy.
And
It might be the net. I hope it's not a flop. I hope it is sort of interesting.
I hope it's good. I want, you know, I like the Fifth Element a lot. And the Fifth Element is also one of those throw everything at the walls and see what sticks kind of pull sci-fis.
Well, what is that artist's name? I can't think of his name right now.
Like visual artist or
He's a visual artist, yeah, that they based a lot of the Fifth Element, like the a lot of the look of it off of.
I mean, a lot of the look comes from Blade Runner, but yeah.
Well,
No.
there's a specific, I think he did some of the art for that movie too. I can't
Oh.
remember his name right now. Anyways, he's a guy that a lot of people have drawn like work from, but specifically he's a big sci-fi guy and he's done a lot of visual art for them. And specifically, the Fifth Element was almost made because of that big, flashy, like that style. So to me, it's sort of,
Yeah.
if he kind of goes for that, I could almost be kind of like, eh, okay.
If he just put some
But
effort into it, like put some effort into it, like, 'cause that's what the problem is like his, like ever since like the Arthur and the Invincibles and all that stuff, he's, it just seems like he's putting the bare minimum amount of effort in these movies just to make a
the
buck.
what?
Arthur and the Invisibles, he made those movies. By the way, you were right. Taken 3 was $48 million production budget. Again,
Yeah.
not taking into account advertising. But yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, anymore you can't. They have to take that out because then it seems like ridiculous that they'd spend that much money.
Right.
Well, no, some of the big productions, like these $180 million movies, after you put that into, advertising them too,
Oh yeah,
that makes them
you're getting into the 300 millions. That's why it's
you could buy
especially.
a small fucking country for some of the money that they're putting into some of these films that you pay like $8, $9 to go see.
Or
It's
don't
insane.
see.
Or don't see, yes.
Right.
In the case of like Jupiter Ascending, those kind of things. But
Right. All right, well, that's the movie news. All right, well, then we'll go ahead and get into our first review for The Krampus. I watched a really funny video of Christoph Waltz explaining the Krampus to Conan O'Brien before there was movies going to be made about it.
oh.
Conan O'Brien was, or no, maybe it was Jimmy Fallon. Who cares? He was explaining the shelf or the Elf on a Shelf, and then Christoph Waltz explained the Krampus.
That sounds
And
vaguely entertaining.
why don't you go ahead and set this movie up? What happens in the Krampus?
Basically, a family of, odds and ends, which most families are, with different viewpoints and different perspectives, they are getting together for the year, the good old Yule log times, and they're sort of fighting and bickering, and so one of the youngest boys in the family kind of wishes for it to be better, like it used to be, and then he kind of throws a mini fit and throws his Santa Claus letter to the wind, and instead of old Saint Nick coming down the chimney, they get the visit from the Krampus. Now, if that sounds like a schlocky setup, it doesn't try to hide that at all.
No.
What the previews didn't give out though, and I don't think that's necessarily wrong because this did it looked like it would be a fun horror comedy, and it
Right.
is that complete and utterly. But what they don't give you is that this is a really good Christmas movie. Like I sort of felt very strange throughout the whole thing because I was like, man, this has like an actual, this isn't just a Christmas movie. They tricked me. But at the same time, like it does really, when it goes horror, okay, you might have to, you might argue or agree with me, but I felt very strange because, so the little ghoulies and stuff that they have in this that are reminiscent of kind of like, this is reminiscent of Gremlins, but the little
Right.
ghoulies that they have in them, they're kind of cartoony and silly looking, but they actually kind of frighten me still. And I usually don't feel kind of weird during movies, so that kind of bothered me. I think it was the editing that made it work, but I'm not sure. Moving on. I thought the performances were fun, and they what they did is they used the when they do this thing, I think it works best in a horror comedy is when they get comedic actors.
Yeah.
And using Adam Scott and David Koechner, I think really worked, as well as Toni Collette. I don't know. I really enjoyed this film. I thought it really worked as a horror film. I don't think it really worked as a comedy, and I think it really worked as a Christmas film. I was, and that's the one that, and the fact that it was all tied together in a very, I mean, it doesn't feel like a movie divided. It feels like exactly what it wants to be.
Right.
And to be honest, for it to be able to do that and not be like, I don't know, like a Silent Night, Deadly Night, where it's just like some slasher movie with a Santa Claus in it. This
Yeah.
is a this is really a Christmas movie. And I feel very strange about it, but I really enjoyed it. And I think that if people dig that kind of horror, non-traditional Christmas narrative, this is definitely one of those films that works. So
Yeah, I would agree with you definitely that all of the genre stuff that it's doing, it actually is more like a traditional Christmas movie than anything else. And you could take, like, I mean, basically, if people don't know, the story of the Krampus is based on an old Germanic fairy tale. And so the director here, Michael Dougherty, who also did Trick or Treat, I guess I want to see his St. Patrick's Day movie, his Easter movie.
Oh,
He should just keep going with it.
he should well, he get you know what? I was actually kind
President's
of
Day.
well because well that would be all those would be fun, but at the same time, I was mildly hesitant because I've only seen one of his films, which was a lot of fun. But I give him props. I really do. I think that he can be a very exciting voice to, like you say these names kind of jokingly, but I'm like, no, I would go see that.
I would too, just to see what his take is. I can't say that I love this movie quite as much as you did.
Oh, you're so wrong. So
Yeah, I'm
wrong.
wrong. I haven't even said a thing yet, and I'm
It
wrong.
doesn't matter. You're wrong.
It certainly is having fun, and it is having a lot of fun with the premise. I wish that it had been either a little scarier or either a little funnier. I think especially as a comedy, it's not that funny. A lot of the jokes are pretty easy, especially the setup of having one side of the family be liberal and one side of the family be conservative. And they're both kind of one-dimensional versions of that. And then you have like grandma who's like, hiding the whiskey jokes throughout the whole movie. Stuff is a little hackneyed, in my opinion. Also, it kind of takes a good while to get off the ground. There's a lot of setting up of the characters and their situation in this town, and I think it takes way too long to get into the meat of the plot, which the horror movie setup aspect of it. And when it happens, it kind of feels like it doesn't have a lot of time to really assert that genre stuff. So I don't know. I
I think
thought
you're completely wrong, but keep going.
I thought that it was I thought that it was having fun, and I thought that it was light, so light that it almost lifted off the ground. I don't know. I kind of felt like it was more like a novelty movie than like a true story that's really being told here. I actually, if it had been a short, in a Trick or Treat like anthology, it maybe could have sustained for what it was trying to do, and it almost sort of felt like it was maybe something like that, and then it got stretched into a full hour and a half.
I disagree. I think it feels like a lot of those classic old, like, I feel like it kind of almost feels like like an 80s movie. And I actually
Yeah.
like that it had a slow setup and it kind of got into its characters, and I liked the characters. I didn't feel like that they were that, while at first they appeared to, as the film unravels, those characters become more full characters and they learn things. And I think it also sort of has, as it goes along and these characters develop and become more interesting. I think it has a really fun setup, and I think it is a very interesting thing to kind of like remember, like just because you have differences, you don't have to like hate, absolutely hate each other. Sometimes it's just about, it's a light, fluffy Christmas kind of message, but it's,
Yeah.
about love and acceptance. And I really thought that that was all tied together under a like a Christmas type story movie. I don't think it takes any more time or less time to get to the point as like a Gremlins movie does. Or like if we're talking more Christmas movies, the one where he's gonna kill himself.
A famous one.
Yeah.
It's a
The one
Wonderful
we
Life.
obviously don't watch. Yeah, It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah.
The one we obviously don't watch that often. No, I think it develops fine. I liked the kind of fun opening of like horrible Black Friday Christmas shopping kind of
Right.
stuff. And
Actually, that, and maybe it, I kind of felt a little misled from that because that was so well done. The opening sequence, it's set to music and it's in slow motion. It's like this Black Friday kind of free for all, and I kind of got the idea like, oh, this is going to be about consumerism, and that's what this is all about. And I think it might have been a more interesting direction to go with
And
than.
that's what I thought it mostly was about. Like, that's the thing, is you're saying that it's not about that, but that's what,
I thought it was
like the
about.
presents being burned and all the other parts where it kind of comes in. It's about getting back to what,
Right. It's
what
about
Christmas
getting.
used to be, or you had to actually worry about the beasties in the forest, and so you'd be gathered around the fire spending time together.
Yeah, I'm just saying it wasn't directly about consumerism. I mean, I guess there was nods to that, but It was mostly about like the family coming together in general.
Well, yeah, but see, that's a symptom to me. And that's what this movie was saying is like all this other crap is it's not necessarily part of what it should be. And this is kind of part of what's kind of driving it apart. When it should be, the holiday is about these things, not the consumerism of it. And I honestly, I think it's kind of a warm movie for being kind of slightly scary and the weird ghoulies that are in it. And again, I thought the comedy works too.
Well, I'll say the saving grace, for me, for this movie is the production design and the creature effects.
Both, yeah, I agree with that.
It reminded me in a good way of two movies in particular. It reminded me of Ernest Scared Stupid. And it also reminded me, these are Halloween movies, but it also reminded me of Pumpkinhead, which is directed by Stan Winston, who usually does effects. And it was like one of the only movies he ever directed, and it's essentially just a big excuse for him to do puppet effects. It had that kind of glee, like you said, of an 80s horror film where the effects team was having a ball
See,
with
and I think it's
creating
kind of
this
it
stuff.
reminds me of like National Lampoon's and like movies like that as
Yeah,
well,
no, it
like.
certainly reminds me a lot of Christmas Vacation. I think actually that's sort of a detractor because it's nowhere near as funny or as good at doing that thing as Christmas Vacation is. So I actually, in a way, I had a little bit more. I had just more kind of fun seeing it, the functionality of it more than anything else. And when the creatures really start coming down heavy towards the third act, and all of the toys come to life and all turn into these creepy things, almost in a very D Joe Dante kind of way, I enjoyed the movie, but I can't say that it was a great movie. I thought
See,
that
I
I don't see it
again.
becoming a perennial like Gremlins is.
No, I thought about buying it right after I watched it because I really did enjoy it. I think that the comedy works. I think that the horror works. And I think what makes it overall more interesting is that it is actually a Christmas movie. It's not actually just like a cheap shot at the holidays. Like it really tries to be something about that and talk about that. And that's what I was mostly surprised about in it. And I don't necessarily agree with your points. It sounds like a very much like kind of a film review is picking apart the loose ends as opposed to like kind of sitting back and just enjoying the thing for what it is, as opposed to the parts of what the expectations of the thing is.
My
So,
expectations were pretty low. I mean,
but you had, but ever all of your complaints are definitely genre complaints. Or definitely have to do with something like, well, I thought the movie should be this or could be this. And I'm saying this is what the movie is, and I think it's good for what it's trying to be itself, as opposed
right.
to its many parts that you're
And what
picking it
I'm
apart to
saying
be.
is, it's not that funny or that scary. And the plot stuff, you can trace back to movies that kind of do what it's trying to do better.
I don't always think that's a fallacy to me because I don't think a horror movie always has to be about being scary.
No, but
I think that it
we've had
works at
this
a
conversation before
similar.
about we've had this conversation before about other genre movies. If it's not going to be one or the other very well, it to me the movie ultimately feels a little tepid. It's not really great at being it's not a very sharp satire, and the characters are pretty loosely drawn, so I'm not really like I didn't walk into the movie wanting to pick it apart or dissect it. I'm just saying I saw what it was trying to do, and I didn't think that it was doing those things very well. I like the production design, I like the creature effects, and I think that when it gets into the anarchistic kind of, joy of just letting it kind of go batshit crazy, that's sort of when it works the best. But I thought that it took a long time to get there, and before we got there, it was a little bland. For a big B movie, it's perfectly fine. I don't think that it's a total wash, and there's certainly things about it that are enjoyable, and I think if you end up going to see it during the Christmas season, you could do a lot worse. But yeah, I just wasn't over the moon about it. So that's the Krampus. You give it 3 days till Christmas?
What?
I don't know. I was trying to come up with a bizarre rating system like an advent calendar, but I only saw the picture in my head, so it didn't work.
Yeah, I wasn't sh anyway. No, I really enjoyed this film. I thought it was a lot of fun.
Alrighty, we'll go ahead and get into H.R. Giger's world. Dark Star, colon, H.R. Giger's world, which you assigned last week. Or
And colon as in the punctuation, not the
well, in this case, it could mean both.
it kind of is both.
All right. So this was directed and written by Belinda Solon, and this pretty much is a documentary sort of focusing on the last few years of the Swiss artist H.R. Giger, who a lot of people are probably most familiar with having designed the creature effects and the production, a lot of the production design for Ridley Scott's Alien back in 1979. He's also done a lot of record covers and for different bands. I know he designed like Jonathan Davis's weird psychosexual mic stand, and a lot of things. He's been commissioned for this or that. So even if you're not really familiar with his style of kind of bizarre, dark surrealism, you've probably seen his stuff in some way or another. He died in 2014, and this documentary is specifically kind of covering the last leg of his life, trying to get his things in order, trying to get this book published and doing some signings and things like that. And along the way, it kind of sprinkles in some of the history of his life and his accomplishments and how he got the big gigs that, you know, got him something like an Academy Award. I mean, you assigned this to me a good while ago. Did you see it more recently, or?
I think 2 weeks ago. Whenever I signed it, I usually watch the movie fairly like a couple days after. So,
Right.
I mean, I have that luxury because I don't edit or anything, but yeah, no, I watched it a while ago, and I mean, it's sort of interesting. I don't know, it still feels like he kind of comes out of that kind of artist idea of being mysterious and not being able to like, you know, penetrate it as much or blah 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 or whatever. He's just this small Swiss man from this village that likes painting, you know, buttholes and vaginal kind of stuff. And I thought it was sort of interesting the kind of time period he was coming out of. As a documentary as a whole, it kind of it's not necessarily the best documentary, but I guess it's one of those ones you forgive because it's about a specific thing, a specific like artist or specific whatever
Right.
that you're somewhat interested in. And with him, it's interesting specifically because he did have a big influence I think on how films look, specifically not just I mean, because Alien, Predator, but I mean the way people thought about designing things after that and monsters and things like that, I think you can really trace it kind of back to him and his kind of his style of things. He also came out of a very, you know, coming out of the 60s, like 70s kind of era, he, you know, it was very different back then, you know. He was also in that period where pop art could kind of actually blend into real art. Because, I mean, when you see that thing when he's releasing all these posters and stuff like that wouldn't necessarily say that like we've got this big huge artist on your hands now. That would be like, oh, this is that guy that's going to go to Comic-Con and release his weird art.
Rather than going like the gallery route or going to the Met or something like that. Yeah. Instead, he kind of went the back doorway of getting his stuff out through posters and paraphernalia.
Yeah, exactly. So it's again, it's not, it's sort of interesting because they kind of open it up in kind of an interesting way where they have it like in this kind of outdoorsy, nice little neighborhood, and then you go inside and he's got all this weird, trashy stuff all piled up everywhere. I don't know. It was interesting to kind of see his lifestyle as a character, but it didn't really necessarily go anywhere.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you. I thought the there wasn't a lot of narrative thrust as a documentary. And there's specific like things that they touch on his life, and his accomplishments, where they show like how he got started in the world of pop art, but only for a little bit. And then they kind of go into a lot of these scenes of him playing with his cat or talking to his wife or talking to his assistant, who was the lead singer of the black metal band Celtic Frost, which I think is funny. And then, and there's a lot of that I feel really weighs down what could be a good, just kind of, it wouldn't even necessarily be the most original way to tell a documentary, but I almost would have preferred just kind of like, let's see his life. Let's see like what he did. And there's a
Well,
lot of footage out there, so I don't know exactly why they went this route, but.
specifically too, I mean, I kind of got what they were going for in the sense that they were trying to show like all the different things that's kind of like led to him drawing the things he draws, like because they kind of, but it kind of gets lost in all the minutia, like because I mean, yeah, he talks about the skulls and stuff like that that he saw when he was a kid and. It kind of explains, I can see what they were going for. It just doesn't seem to all kind of like come together. I don't know. I prefer in a trashy little, because we kind of talked about this beforehand, but I prefer in like a trashy little documentary, which I kind of feel like this falls in under. I prefer it to be a little bit more, to be a little bit more narrative, I guess, is where I'm going with it, because it doesn't really end up doing much. He just kind of, I mean, you can see his influence and you can see everything like that, but you don't really get to see, like, I mean, you barely get to see into like what is really, it's not very cerebral. We don't get to see what his world is really. We get to see all the things around him and we get to see what his daily life is like, but what really influenced what I guess I was more looking for what influences him like cerebrally as a, that sort of a worldview as opposed to like the artifice of his life. Because, it doesn't matter who, how tortured the person could be, making depraved films, but in general, they have to feed and bathe and wash themselves. And if they don't clean up their house, it gets, unmanageable. Like those were the things I'm like, this is the least interesting things you could be showing me about H.R. Giger.
No, that's it. That's exactly how I felt, because there's actually a documentary it reminded me a lot of is the Roger Ebert documentary Life Itself. And I kind of had the same problems with that one, which was like, here's this guy who was a really interesting person and he did a lot of cool things and he won a Pulitzer Prize and went to all these festivals, but you're going to show me the bulk of the film is him basically dying. H.R. Giger's really not well in this movie. He's like it's kind of hard to watch because you can tell he's really struggling to just walk and talk and get things done. Even signing the books is like a struggle. And I know that they kind of want it to be sort of about that, and that's why they sprinkle in his history kind of like memories, that he's like remembering how he got to that point. But I yeah it's like, why show me for the majority of the film him at this point?
Well, and to me, it's not even necessarily about him at that point. It's just there's more. You tell me it's about his world, but but when you say that, you're not talking about. I mean, I was taking a little bit more figuratively than literal, and that's kind of what I wanted was more about. Tell us about, what drive and they kind of started like that because now that I think about it, they had like an art. At the start of the film, they have like an art like curator and stuff like that talking about it. And then you don't see that through the rest of the film.
A little bit more of that would have been nice to kind of contextualize. Also, given that his stuff is so intricate and so detailed, and they do have, there's a few scenes, some older footage of him just going to town with that airbrush gun, and I can't, I mean, I don't maybe know off the top of my head, but I can't think of anybody who's as detailed and as talented with an airbrush gun.
No, that looks extremely, extremely
And that kind of
difficult.
footage, I could, I was just eating up. But yeah, I don't know, him playing with his cat and him kind of like being bossed around or moved around from this convention to that convention.
Well, I mean, that's the mundane stuff, and I get that that's part of an artist's life. And I mean, that is, but again, the thing that you like about an artist is never the art. Well, let's back up there. Most people, if usually you like the art more than the person. There
Right.
are artists that I don't actually necessarily like them that much as a person. I just want to know what the next thing they're doing because they're talented at doing that. And kind of in this sense, that's what I wanted about H.R. Geiger. I'm sure he was a nice man, or maybe not. I don't know. I didn't really get a sense out of that really from this
It
movie
kind of
either.
creepy, like all the time.
He kind of looks like a mole man.
It kind of looks like, yeah, like a bit like an owl person.
Yeah, I kind of feel bad because he's like this little old man, and I'm sure I'll look like that too one day.
No, yeah, I know.
Like,
But
I'm not
I
trying to like harp on him as a person. I'm just
no,
saying it doesn't go anywhere.
it fits his, it fits, you know, whatever. Like he's kind of like the most stereotypical, like creepy German looking sounding artist. Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed the movie as much as I enjoyed looking at his art. And I think that, you know, if you like his stuff already, if you're already all in, I think there's enough here to enjoy. Like you can sit through it. But yeah, I'd say as a documentary, especially for those who are uninitiated, you're probably better off just going to Barnes and Noble and getting a book and just looking at the art.
Right. I can't think of I see that there is some other like stuff about H.R. Geiger out there, so maybe there's a better version of this out there, but
Yeah.
just specifically how it was set up and explained to me, I was expecting something different. But that's movies.
Okay, so next week we'll do another Christmas movie. This is a Christmas special that just appeared on Netflix, so this is another Netflix original. And I have a feeling like the longer we do the show, the more of these are gonna pop up. We're going to do a have a very Murray Christmas. The Bill Murray Christmas special directed by Sofia Coppola, that was made specifically for this year. And if anybody has anything to say about that, or Dark Star, or The Krampus, if you happen to watch it, go ahead and email us and give us your thoughts at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast, where we post all of our news items and some that we don't talk about. You can also find us on Twitter at JabberPodcast. We are available on iTunes and Stitcher Radio, Podbean, Zune, Pocket Cast, and the Windows Podcast Network, as well as Player.fm. So if you use any of those to listen to podcasts, then you probably already know because you probably are listening to us through one of those. You can read my movie reviews that I do weekly at the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. I have some reviews and content available on the Seattle-based website MacGuffin at macguff.in/author/cassidy. Richard's blog is over there at rdwally.weebly.com. And Brad, Amanda, and Alyssa no longer do Quarter Life Crisis, but Brad is still going to town on his new literary blog, Panel and Frame, at medium.com/panel-frame. Be sure to listen to Leland's podcast over in Olympia, Washington, dampercast.com, who we had on the show last week to help me review Creed. And check out my spot over on the Listening Party podcast with Rod and Denise. I still think that's the latest episode that's up, or maybe the second to last one that's up now. And be sure to listen to Patrick, who sent us a letter over at his podcast, Almost Educational and Make Dad Read Comics. Until then, we'll see you next week.
Okay, have a good one. Bye.
Bye.